Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We are coming off of May when we saw record-setting dryness in important agricultural communities like Omaha, Nebraska. Only 17 hundredths of an inch of rainfall in the month of May, breaking records that had been set with about a half an inch of rain in 1925 and May of 1989.
Record dryness in areas that are normally wet. Brad Rippey, USDA meteorologist.
That record dryness extended eastward into parts of Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New York. We saw less than a tenth of an inch of rain during the month of May in Reading, Pennsylvania. That turned out not only to be the record driest May, but the second driest month ever on record. Records in Reading go back to before the Civil War, so that is an impressive period of record.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Today we return to our series on the economic toll of a changing climate, this time with a bipartisan hearing.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is chairman of the Senate Budget Committee.
We will hear from farmers on the front line about climate risks to the agriculture sector, the associated economic and budgetary costs, and the important steps that we can take to help mitigate those costs. As we've highlighted in this series, the ongoing climate crisis poses enormous threats to people's well-being on this planet and to our industries, our livelihoods, and our entire economy. Our nation's agricultural landscape is changing. Unpredictable weather has always been a challenge to raising crops and livestock, but farmers are seeing more frequent and extreme weather variability than ever before. Events that used to be considered anomalies now occur with increasing regularity. For decades, California faced record-breaking droughts. This year, California crops face record floods. Last year, Kansas suffered a triple-digit heat wave that killed thousands of cattle. This year, Kansas is struggling with a drought, forcing farmers to abandon their wheat fields. In 2018, Hurricane Michael swept through Florida and Georgia, damaging cotton, pecan, and poultry farms. Last year, Florida citrus farms hit historic production lows after twin hurricanes Ian and Nicole. Atypical events are the new norm, leading to lower crop yields, lower livestock productivity, worse pests and disease, and reduced soil fertility. Consumers see the impacts of climate change on their grocery bills and will continue to bear the brunt of lower crop yields and increased production costs. As climate change affects food production in our country, it's also affecting food production around the world. The United States imports a third of our fresh vegetables, more than half our fresh fruit, and 94% of the seafood we consume. Global weather variability disrupting supply chains and global agricultural productivity will have far-reaching effects on food prices and supply. U.S. government programs that protect growers and stabilize the agricultural economy move the costs of damaging weather to the federal government. The largest is the Federal Crop Insurance Program. In 2022, the federal government spent over $15 billion on that program, which included over $11.6 billion in premium subsidies. Indemnities, what the government paid out to those affected, in the last year were around $18 billion. As climate change makes farming and raising livestock more unpredictable, that cost will continue to grow. Spending on other disaster assistance programs is also likely to grow as extreme weather events become more prevalent. In just 3 years of the emergency relief program, the federal government has already disbursed more than $7.4 billion to help agricultural producers. This is on top of the wildfire and hurricane indemnity program, which provided payments to farmers for losses caused by hurricanes, wildfires, and other natural disasters. Ranking Member Grassley and I agree that the agricultural sector can play a role in the climate solution. As we'll hear today, climate-smart agriculture can drive down greenhouse gas emissions such as methane. It can improve soil health and sequester carbon. And it can help make farms stronger in the face of a changing climate. Farmers know that climate-smart practices such as cover crops, no-till, and diversification increase food production and make agriculture more resilient. Farmers like those here today are on the front lines of building resilience and adapting to a changing agricultural landscape. Major agricultural corporations like Cargill warn that Midwestern production of some commodities like wheat and corn could drop by as much as 69% by the end of the century, absent significant emissions mitigation or adaptation.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The thing that's also impossible to talk about in many ways, it's our demographics.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert in a recent interview with Forbes.
And you know, it's a big word, but it's everything because it's the cascade of your ability to grow the economy. It's the ability to have innovation. It is the driver of almost 100% of the future debt. Actually, 100% of the future debt being healthcare costs, the collapse of the Social Security Trust Fund, those sorts of things. We in the industrialized West and the United States included have gotten much older. And yet it's almost a thing we're terrified to talk about.
He says that's the biggest, most pressing issue facing the country and says all you have to do is look at the math.
If someone actually just reads, and look, it's one of the reasons I respect what you do so much is you're one of the few outlets that's doing sort of adult conversation, adult interviews. Much of our information we either get through our phones or we see on cable news is whatever the outrageous shiny object is of the today. What can we be enraged at today? Yet every single second, we borrow, what, $51,000 every second. And by the end of the decade, we're close to $90,000 a second. It's that is the greatest threat to this republic. But it's also impossible to talk about because the vast majority of that growth and that borrowing, that spending, is healthcare costs.
And on the recent debt ceiling debate.
Look, the debt ceiling is just has been around for, you know, 100 plus years. That's just the nature of it. What enraged me and really should upset anyone who actually owns a calculator was the lack of understanding of the mechanisms around it. You know, every time someone was saying, we're going to default. Okay. For those of us who actually went into, showed up at our, you know, business classes, default is when you don't pay the interest on your bonds or don't pay off the bond when it's, time. We were never going to default. Now, that doesn't mean you didn't have a horrible stressor if 30% of every dollar government spends is borrowed. That's a technical default. And it's almost like there was purposely this attempt to scare financial markets. Though if you actually watched bond futures and those through this whole scenario, they stayed stable. Those in the futures market of sovereign debt, those things, they're so much smarter than the rest of us. They didn't play the hysteria game. And why I'm annoyed with this is we still avoided the really difficult conversation. Okay. So we've now been able to squeeze down spending by a couple trillion dollars over 10 years, but it's coming from 11% of the budget, which is the non-defense discretionary. So you've taken it from spending $700 billion on government to $600 billion. Wonderful. But that's not where the growth in spending is over the decade. That non-discretionary was going to be pretty much flat. The incredible amount of spending growth and borrowing growth is our healthcare entitlements. It's Medicare. And we have a moral obligation to be able to keep that societal promise. But we are in such avoidance of the discussion of how to finance it, how to make it work, how to change the actual price of delivering that healthcare that we had all this excitement, all this dancing, and never actually really talked about the problem.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
My name is Diana Tolipson Torres, and I am the CEO of the UFW Foundation, based in California and serving farm worker families around the country.
She testified recently before the Senate Judiciary Committee looking at the H-2A visa program.
Our nation's food supply relies on about 2 million farm workers, about half of whom are U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents, according to the federal government. Farm work is a career, and farm workers across the country often will proudly share about the decades that they have worked feeding the nation and, in fact, much of the world. And yet, our fellow U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents who are farm workers often live in poverty and struggle to feed their own families. 50% of the men and women they work alongside either do not have documentation or are here through the H-2A guest worker program. lack of legal status combined with a shameful history of excluding the industry from basic labor laws, such as overtime pay or the right to join a union, makes farmworkers vulnerable to a range of abuses. The threat of immigration enforcement is a form of coercion that employers can use against both undocumented and H-2A workers. U.S. citizens and work-authorized colleagues also often work in fear, as they know that they can easily be replaced by more vulnerable workers. Esther from California, who has worked as a farm worker in the U.S. for 25 years, picking grapes, vegetables, and oranges, asked me to tell you, I wish to tell our lawmakers in Congress to please pass legalization for farm workers so we may see our families without fear, that we may work without fear, and that we may contribute to this country without fear. Today, the United States has a choice. We can recognize the incredible value of farm workers and work towards the day when the industry is characterized by workers who work and live without fear because they have a way to earn citizenship and enjoy equal labor rights. This choice will enable farm workers to stay in agriculture and help the industry and our rural communities thrive. Or we can continue to turn a blind eye to the fact that too many farm workers work without legal authorization and that the existing H-2A visa program has become the worst source of human trafficking among U.S. visa programs, and workers in the program too often have their rights violated. The number of H-2A jobs approved by the DOL has increased rapidly from 79,000 H-2A positions in 2010 to 371,000 in 2022. It is hard to know which stories to tell when it comes to the lives of too many H-2A workers. I hope you have read my testimony and understand that the problems for H-2A workers most often begin before they even get to this country, because the system is dependent on recruiters that are able to discriminate in the workers they choose and often insist on the payment of the legal recruitment fees. Accordingly, H-2A workers come to this country largely indentured. Additionally, federal law excludes H-2A workers from the Migrant and Seasonal Agricultural Worker Protection Act, which protects farm workers' rights. Workers live in substandard conditions, work in extreme conditions for well over 10 hours a day, experience wage theft, and do not speak up because they will only be chosen to come back to the U.S. in future years if they don't complain. This is why our increasing reliance on the H-2A guest worker program in its current form threatens the conditions of all farm workers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think progress is always made better with carrots instead of sticks.
At a recent Senate Budget Committee hearing on the changing agricultural landscape, Iowa Farm Bureau President Brent Johnson.
Now, voluntary incentive-based programs have made a lot of positive progress in agriculture in the entire history of the industry as this country has been known. And as I've said before, you know, when I was a kid and Mr. Grassley was a young Farm Bureau member back then, you know, our family was plowing our fields. And the progression of practices through the years and through the generations was something that was inherently built, bred, and innovative on farms across the entire country. Just it's natural to a farmer to want to make progress, to want to do better, to want to be more efficient. And if you remove that incentive through burdensome regulations, my focus changes to meeting a regulation instead of meeting innovation, instead of finding new opportunities that maybe nobody's even thought of yet. So how can you regulate something that's a brand new idea? So that's where my comments are based on. To not stifle new ideas and future progress.
Johnson from Calhoun County, Iowa, talks about the importance of innovation.
I am a fifth generation farmer. Actually, my great great grandfather established our farm in 1893. So, and he came from a farm in Germany. So, our family history in agriculture goes back multi generations. So, as far as adopting precision agriculture on our farm, It's become a necessity in when it comes to management of agriculture. So as many of the panelists have described already, the risks are great and growing. So the ability to make progress, to me, starts with measurement and management. So if I can't measure it, I can't make progress. So the ability to adopt precision agriculture, we've walked through the steps as technology has come through the generations. When I was a little kid, technology meant how much tillage could you do. And I remember being in a tractor with a plow, and to be a good farmer, you had to turn your fields black because that's the technology that we had. Fast forward, my family adopted conservation tillage, and now as I started farming, we've adopted strip tillage and no tillage, and so the progress comes with technology advancements, and that also includes the ability for the seed in genetics to be able to handle that, and the ability to manage machinery properly and find those efficiencies, and so to measure what's happening in the field, understand where the parts of the field can actually do better than they're doing today, and other parts of the field that, we don't need to spend so much money or time or inputs on because the potential just isn't there. It allows me to focus dollars, and that allows me to then manage my risk in a way to manage those inputs. Agriculture has so many aspects about it that are not in our control, and when you do find those things, the best managers take those opportunities and manage those as best you can. And for me, precision agriculture has allowed me to increase my yields while reducing my inputs. So my efficiency numbers have actually been growing.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think there's a more seriousness.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert talks about the changing relationship between Democrats and Republicans.
The debt ceiling agreement, it was ultimately bipartisan, and it was because there was a serious approach to what's going on in the society, in our government. Unlike my brothers and sisters on the left, who just wanted to raise the debt ceiling and avoid the conversation. Much of my criticism before, when there was unified Democrat control, was the insatiable appetite to keep spending, this functionally lying to the American people, saying, well, if we just raise taxes on people over 400,000, we can finance things. And look, 400,000 and up in income is 2% of the population. We're not going to finance even a fraction of the debt, the borrowing, and the coming borrowing on that 2% of the population. It's sort of the political folklore so many people have run their campaigns on. And look, Republicans are sinners too. We often say, well, if we got rid of foreign aid or waste and fraud, every dime of foreign aid would cover about 12 days of borrowing. So yes, my answer is Republicans were completely frozen out in the previous couple of years. That's Democrat unified government. Now that we have divided government, if you're going to accomplish anything to the point where you get a signature on it, it requires, you have to work with both sides. And that's one of the difficulties for everyone here, because we all got so used to sort of the posturing of no Republicans ideas were going to pass, all Democrat ideas were going to pass. And now we're forced to actually talk to each other.
In a recent interview with Forbes, he talks about what Congress really needs to be doing.
The Social Security Trust Fund is not magically going to heal itself. The new projections, substantially because of inflation, and my feelings that much of inflation was 100% set up by a combination of monetary policy and Democrat spending. But healthcare inflation is two and a half times faster than mean CPI. Meaning we're seeing some new calculations like Bloomberg Intelligence last week said by the end of the decade, we're at 130% debt to GDP. If that math is accurate, that means over this 10 years, we will borrow more than all the publicly held debt that exists today. That's coming off the rails. Even Moody's Analytics has us at 121% of debt to GDP 9 budget years from now. That's everything. That's what takes down republics. And yet we will sit here and do the shiny objects. And so you ask, what should we be doing with Democrats? Democrats own calculators. I don't know if there's batteries in them, but you know, I'm sorry, that was sarcastic. This is the thing that will ultimately crush the poor, crush the economy. And the ones who really get destroyed are people who are trying to, you know, survive, you know, their retirements, you know, have retirement security, and younger populations who are going to pay just stunning amounts of taxes. And yet, how often is this part of your interviews, your conversations?
Arizona Representative David Schweikert. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Like many farm kids, I grew up wanting to do the same thing that my dad did.
Adam Litch, operations manager at L&M Farms, North Central Florida, testifying before a Senate Judiciary Committee.
I grew up in the fields alongside him and other workers doing everything from chopping cotton to cropping sand lugs. It was all hard work. I remember over 30 years ago, it started to become harder for my family to find workers. Our existing workforce had begun to age out, and others no longer wanted to pursue this type of work. During this time, a man from Mexico, Ruben, stopped by asking for a job. He shared with me the love he had for a place he called home and the importance of making sacrifices for your family. He simply wanted to be here in the U.S. so that his family in Mexico could have a better life. As the years went by, Ruben started to recruit more workers from Mexico. Our family operation had no other way to meet our seasonal work needs. That's how, from an early age, I began to understand that American agriculture was dependent on immigrant workers to get the jobs done. Fast forward over 30 years and not much has changed. There have been no fixes to the problem that I witnessed firsthand all those years ago, and America's food system still requires seasonal workers. As American farmers, we face a variety of challenges. Most of these are things we cannot control, like weather, market conditions, rapid inflation, and supply disruptions, like during the recent COVID-19 pandemic. However, the single biggest issue we face is the unprecedented shortage of domestic labor and the restricted access to a H-2A guest workforce. The H-2A program is currently our only option. The program is greatly flawed and made even more challenging by the federal agency entrusted to administer it. With a volatile wage structure and program restrictions such as seasonal need, which does not work well in this era of modern agriculture. Additionally, under the H-2A program, a self-inflating adverse effect wage rate, or AWER, is set each year for workers, the methodology for which lacks visibility, accuracy, and stability for growers. The AWER was originally created to protect American workers who perform the same duties as those on the H-2A contracts, so they would not be adversely affected. But that is no longer the case, since there are no American workers willing to do these jobs. In fact, American families are the ones being adversely affected, as our workforce crisis will continue to drive food prices even higher. We treat our workers fairly, and most of them, over 93%, come back year after year. It is important that they earn a fair wage that provides us stability. We want them to come back every year. We want a program that works for all involved, but if nothing changes, there will certainly be a sharp decrease in production, affecting not only farmers and farm workers, but the rural communities in which we operate who also depend on agriculture. For 2023, the AWER in Florida increased 15.5%, and we received notice of this just 38 days before it went into effect on January the 1st. We had workers on the way from Mexico when we found out we had nearly a $2 per hour increase coming. At the same time, our crops were mostly all planted, giving us little to no time to react. Our crops are touched by human hands at every step of the production, harvest, and packing process. Labor alone makes up between 40 and 50% of our total cost to grow and harvest most of our crops. As a result of the AWER changes this year, my company will see at least a $1.4 million payroll increase over the prior year. These rising labor costs tied to the H-2A program, exacerbated by a new Labor Department wage rule, make it nearly impossible to compete with countries that pay a fraction of what we do for their workforce. It is often said that food security is national security. We must create a pathway to earned legal status for those in the current domestic workforce, have wage stabilization, and greater H-2A program access to ensure that the U.S. can feed itself, but it is up to Congress to act. In closing, I will ask you this. Will you support our American food system by passing agricultural workforce reform, or will we have to rely on our foreign competitors to step up and meet our food and nutrition needs the next time our supply chain is so greatly disrupted? We need Congress to support and seed real change on this issue before it is too late. The future of American agriculture, especially the fresh fruit and vegetable industry, depends on it.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One is the harvest price option. Currently, with Prevent Plant, the only price that is applicable is a spring price. But much like the counterparts of those acres that are being harvested, we are wanting feedback on whether to allow the Prevent Plant payment calculation to be based upon the higher of the projected price or the harvest price.
Marcia Bunger, Administrator of the Risk Management Agency.
The second topic will be the 1-in-4 rule. Currently, we have the rule of planting one in the last 4 years to then be eligible for Prevent Plant and how it applies to folks that are in those Prevent Plant types of situations. In addition, we would also like some input on whether we allow a 10% buy-up on Prevent Plant, which currently is not an option, and then take a look at also contract price, whether Prevent Plant acre costs are higher for contracted crops